Netflix monopolies, how much chewing gum is inside your iPhone 7, Twitter on your TV, a review of the new Oliver Stone movie, Snowden, all that and a whole lot more coming up on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1600, recorded Friday, September 16th, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Zerto, virtual replication and disaster recovery technology that gives you the confidence to keep your business moving forward no matter what comes your way. Zerto empowers you to protect and recover your IT assets, move to the cloud, and know that you're ready for anything. Get a free readiness assessment for your data center at confidencecio.com.
And by Gazelle, the online marketplace for buying and selling used gadgets. Shop from a variety of certified pre-owned electronics or trade one in for cash. Give a new life to use device. Visit gazelle.com today.
And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/TNT and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about everything you need to know that happened in technology today. Mm-hmm. We are the Elsa and Anna of technology.
It's Anna.
Anna.
Yeah, it's Anna, not Anna. That's a rookie move there in the world of Frozen.
I wasn't talking about Frozen.
Oh. I don't know where we're at right
Elsa
now.
Elsa and Anna.
Yeah, there we go.
I'm sorry,
That sounds more like what my kids say all the time.
Okay.
But really, you're Megan and I'm Jason.
Mm-hmm. But
if we were Elsa and Anna, who would you be?
Oh, Elsa. Of course.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm cool with having the braided pigtails. Yeah. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
not really. Netflix has seen huge success in broadening its streaming service to include original content to the tune of around $6 billion spent in 1 year. That actually tops HBO's significant spend of $2 billion per year for its originals. It sounds like some big executives in Hollywood are starting to think Netflix has a growing monopoly on content, considering the fact that the company produces way more content than single networks at the moment. On top of that, Netflix runs its business differently from traditional studios, so those involved with the productions themselves often know very little about the actual success of their content offerings. I mean, Netflix has just been on a crazy roll. They only really started doing this original content thing back in 2013 with House of Cards. Now they've got plans to release 30 original series in just this year, 600 hours of scripted content. I mean, they're basically what these executives are saying is that Netflix is swallowing up all of the original content. Don't do that anymore. We're scared.
I think this is balderdash.
Balderdash.
Is silly.
I love that word.
This is silly because, I mean, an illegal monopoly, because if you think about like the networks, ABC, for example, Disney, they own Disney, they own Pixar, they own Marvel, they own ESPN, they own publishing companies. You know, they're a monopoly. And, you know, so I don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, they just seem to think that Netflix is swimming in money and has deep, deep pockets to swallow up all of the original, you know, content that all the studios are creating throughout Hollywood so that they don't get a piece. And I don't know, like, monopoly seems like a pretty far stretch.
Yeah.
I can understand the concern, though. I mean, if you know, Netflix playing this super aggressive, but that's also, I mean, in this case, at least at this point, just seems like a business strength. It seems to be working really well for Netflix, so I don't know.
I think they're swimming in data, and so they are able to give people what they actually want.
Right.
And we are willing to pay for it with money as opposed to just our advertising eyeballs. And so it's working. Like, they know what we want because they see when we pause, they see when we stop, they see what we watch. And then they give us what we want to see.
Yeah.
I'm not complaining about that.
It seems very similar to kind of the fears of, you know, the move into digital music. You know, you have the old legacy studios that have had have made an insane amount of money based on an old formula. And then this tradition, this transition comes into the digital world, and you know, it's played by different rules. It's played by newer, more updated rules based on new technology. And in some cases, that tends to make the people kind of firmly entrenched in the old system fear that, you know, well, I can't make money in the same ways that I used to. Mm-hmm. One of their concerns is that Netflix could demand its own rates if it owns most of the town's content, you know, of the content that's out there already. Then Netflix can kind of go around and kind of use that as, you know, throw around its muscle and say, well, now these are the rates and what are you going to do about it? We already have almost everything. But that just seems like, you know, new business approach versus old business approach, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes it bad or good. Meanwhile, 21st Century Fox is suing Netflix in what it calls a brazen campaign of poaching top industry talent. Sometimes they say illegally breaching employment contracts to do so. Specifically, the suit focuses on two executives who had contracts with Fox taking them through 2019, yet Netflix hired them away knowing that it would be a breach in their contract. And I think this kind of goes, well, okay, if there's a knowing, you know, breach of contract, that's one thing. But hiring away executives, I mean, if it's legal, which Fox seems to think that it's not or whatever, and they're just upset that Netflix is, you know, has the ability to do this, then again, I think that just kind of goes back to, yeah, well, maybe they're not playing by the same rules that you're used to playing, you know, for the last 100-some-odd years.
Well, I mean, it seems to me like I always thought that they were, you know, people were, networks and such were stealing each other's people all the time. I mean, right. They have the money, but what they're saying is, so these people were under contract and Netflix said, you know, we'll buy out your contract, you know, if you get sued, we'll pay for it, you know, mm-hmm. So that's basically what they're saying. And then Fox is saying that's illegal because they have no standing. Like, their standing was right. Like, we will sue you if you break your contract. And Netflix was like, that's not, you know, no problem at all. We're rolling in cash and we're happy to have you for that reason. So, yeah, I don't know.
Netflix is just a big disruptor right now. And
yes,
I don't think Hollywood
absolutely.
Likes that very much.
Yeah, they are threatened by Netflix. And, yeah. And it makes sense. They should be. Yeah. So while you are still waiting for your iPhone to arrive, our friends over at iFixit have already taken theirs apart. Now, teardowns for the new iPhone 7 Plus and the new Apple Watch Series 2 are live over at iFixit. Here is some of what they found under the hood. Tons of rubber seals and extra glue for waterproofing, or water resisting, as Apple calls it. That extra glue is notable since if you have to fix something on the phone and you don't take it to Apple, it might not be as water resistant as before. Also, there's a barometric vent and a bigger taptic engine where the headphone jack used to be. So that's in the phone. They do x-rays too, which is very cool because then you can really see the intricate parts of, you know, everything that's going on in there. There's, I think if you're watching the show
engine
right now, you can see what's going on.
Especially when you think of the scale. I mean, this thing is pretty tiny, but you know, with the x-ray, it looks a lot larger, but it's neat to kind of see the mechanisms working and to kind of know what the actual kind of tactical feel of that is when you have a device in your hand. That tiny little module doing that little shaking makes a big difference.
I love reading these teardowns. It's really fascinating to me what's inside. They now have these tri-point screws, which are not proprietary, but are difficult to find tools to get them out of the phone. They've already seen these in the Apple Watch, but this is the first time they've been used in a phone. The new battery is more powerful in the phone, but it's actually smaller in size and lighter. So that is interesting.
It's not much more powerful, though. It's 2,900 milliamp hours. The 6S Plus was 2,750. And they're claiming you get an hour extra battery life out of this, out of that bump up. I'm not sure if that bump up would translate to that necessarily, but they're obviously, you know, also doing lots of software optimizations under the hood mm-hmm. to make that happen. So
absolutely. Yeah. iFixit also tore down the Apple Watch Series 2. They found stronger adhesive for waterproofing and a battery with the promised 32% increase in power. Now, Apple's not claiming that the Apple Watch battery will last any longer than the current Apple Watch, the Series 1, if you call it that. But you will need the extra battery because of the always-on GPS, which is unique to the Apple Watch Series 2. And if you ever want to replace your watch battery, iFixit says you will never be able to get enough chewing gum in there to make the watch waterproof again. Why do they do these teardowns? Is it just destructive? Is it just to amuse us? It's really to show that, or to find out if Apple or any other company's products that they tear down has made it easily, their products easily fixable, so that if something goes wrong, like, so, you know, the common tinkerer could maybe take it apart and replace the battery or replace, you know, any manner of the parts. But as per usual, Apple has not made this easy at all, which, you know, is questionable from an environmental perspective.
Sure, definitely from an environmental standpoint. I always have to wonder how much of a consideration, tear down of their device really is in the manufacturing process. Like, I feel like the point, you know, for most manufacturers is put it together as designed, get it in the hands of customers, and maybe make it accessible by authorized people to do it. And Apple has done some of that. Some of the battery fasteners have little pull tabs or whatever. So if you really need to get to the battery, you pull the tab and it kind of loosens it. So, you know, instead of securing it in there with just a ton of glue or whatever.
Or chewing gum,
as iFixit says. There's some consideration for that. But really, when it boils down to it, Apple doesn't want the everyday tinkerer in there and probably doesn't care, you know, that they are upset that they can't get in there. They just want their authorized dealers or their authorized repair places to be able to have that kind of access. And as long as they're making it available to those people, then I think Apple considers that it's done its job.
And when you talk about the iPhone, they will say that it has to do with that secure enclave. Like, you mess with that and then you mess with the security. They don't want to make it easy to open that up and do something so that you can no longer have that fingerprint sensor working. You know, they don't want someone to be able to easily hack the fingerprint sensor. But what I think is also important is just to consider how we don't fix things anymore. Like, we just, I mean, I remember probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, my father-in-law, his DVD player was broken and he had the screwdriver out and he was like going to fit. And I was like, are you going to try to fix your DVD player? Like, why don't you just buy a new one?
They're like $30.
I know. And he's a mechanical engineer and he just looked at me like, I was insane. And I just sat there like, he's right. You know, we should fix things. We shouldn't just replace them all the time.
Although a lot of times with consumer electronics, and definitely I would consider Apple maybe a step above just general consumer electronics, but yeah, sure, it's fixable, but it's never quite the same, mm-hmm. you know. And actually, you know what? Apple falls in that category too, right? Like they say with the Apple Watch battery, once it's replaced, the Apple Watch 2 will not be waterproof anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, there's just not enough, you know, there was so much adhesive in there packing it all together that you likely could not replicate that after you do something as simple as changing the battery. And we know our devices, you know, they need battery swaps from time to time. Mm-hmm. It's not an uncommon thing to have. I just think that in general, consumer electronics, like, yeah, you can fix them. It's never quite the same. And then in a lot of the cases, yeah, the price is so low to replace them that we've gotten out of the habit because it's like, you know, cost versus convenience, you know, like, yeah, whatever, $30 for a new DVD player. I saved myself the headache, but what is the greater cost there?
Right. Yeah, we cracked the screen on the, I think it was my Samsung S2 or S3, and we got one of the iFixit kits. You know, that's also why they do this, because they sell all the kits with everything that you need, all the pieces that you need.
Yeah,
it was
cool
really
kits.
Hard to do, but it was a good experience because my daughter had dropped it, and so it was like her responsibility to get in there and, you know, and try to replace the screen, which we did together, and, you know, it was a great experience. Then she dropped it again and broke it, and we got rid of it.
Yeah. probably should say, full disclosure, we've had iFixit as a sponsor on this network from time to time. So for what that's worth. So much of this year's U.S. election has already been orchestrated in many ways, good and bad, on social networks. And the upcoming presidential debates aren't willing to be the only ones outside of that trend. Both Facebook and Google are getting involved in the three debates by offering data about what its users are searching for and saying about the election, candidates, and issues leading up to the events. And beyond that, Facebook will actually also work directly with the moderators of these debates to help them come up with questions to be asked of the presidential hopefuls. So this is going to be an interesting triple or trifecta of presidential debates. hinging around to certain degrees social networks, which kind of makes sense. I feel like this was the first like major presidential election where social networks weren't just this little thing to kind of get in there in some sort of fabricated way. To a large degree, many people are making their decisions based on what they see on these social networks as relates to the election.
Exactly. And I was trying to get my mind around this story. They say that Facebook is the official social media sponsor of the debates. And I was like, what does that mean? Why do they need a social media sponsor? Like, we can't talk about them on Twitter. And the Commission on Presidential Debates, they say they've collaborated with not just technology companies, but academics and media organizations also to engage the American public in these conversations before. So it's not like they're just hopping on Facebook and, asking, getting their questions from there. Because what I wonder about Facebook is Facebook what people really care about, or is it what people want other people to think they care about?
You mean what they're putting on Facebook?
Yeah, what people are, like the questions they're asking, the people that, Facebook. What are the things that you really do care about, but maybe you don't want to, talk about in front of your friends? Like, that's the thing that I worry about. I mean, whoever you are supporting in this election, like, I think that it's sometimes hard for people to, get out there and say who they're supporting. Some people don't talk about it on Facebook because they don't want to be attacked by, whichever side that they're not supporting. So I don't know. So I was comforted to hear that they're not just going to Facebook to get the questions.
We're going to dive into your stream and see what we can find. Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. Jason Owl says.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear that's not happening too. Yeah. That would be kind of frightening. No, it sounds like it's going to be more of like an organized, complicit sort of thing as far as this is concerned, actually utilizing Facebook Live for part of it. Debates are going to be streaming online to Facebook, to Twitter, YouTube, and Yahoo. So if you don't have, cable or antenna or whatever at home, plenty of ways to watch these. And then, of course, simultaneously, you'll be able to kind of tune in with Facebook Live. Snapchat has plans for live stories from the actual different debate locations. So I'm sure those will be really, really cool to follow. And yeah, it just kind of feels like the next step of the town hall. It's like the town hall came along. I can't remember when they first started doing town halls with debates and, televising those. I remember it back with Bill Clinton back in the, the 90s or whatever. And this seems like the town hall, but for everyone, literally everyone on the internet, if you want to try and get involved. I mean, there's a lot of people.
It is. Yeah. I mean, and make no mistake, like Facebook is in this for their own good as well, just as the networks are that want to air the debates. I mean, they say they're going to be helping the students to Facebook Live. The students that are at the town hall meetings are going to help them, show them how to use Facebook Live so that, they can use it. And it's like, if they really wanted people just to be able to live stream their experience, maybe they would say, oh, by the way, you can also Periscope it, or you can also, all the other YouTube live streaming, all the ways you can live streaming. But they're like, that's what the official sponsorship means. Like, they want more people to go on Facebook. So,
well, and it's proof to those who are watching the debates and seeing that let's say if they hadn't heard or gotten onto Facebook before, this is the kind of conversation, this is the kind of public discussion that happens on a Facebook, and you should check it out for yourself. Yeah, that's exactly why the sponsorship even exists.
Mm-hmm. The USA Today reports that the Associated Press, Vice Media, and Gannett, which is USA Today's parent company, are using the Freedom of Information Act to sue the FBI to find out how they broke into the iPhone of the San Bernardino shooter. The lawsuit claims that the public deserves to know more about how they got into the phone, who the government paid, and how much they paid to hack it. The White House claims that the Obama administration has tried to be as transparent as possible about the unlocking of the phone. So, yeah, I think this is great. I think if there's a vulnerability in iOS or on certain iPhones, we definitely need to know about it. Wired just reported yesterday, I think, that a Cambridge University researcher has said that he thinks that he knows how they got in. It was like a NAND mirroring technique that requires actual physical access to, the phone, contact with the chip to get the info. So, of course, the San Bernardino case, this is over. They say they have the information. But, the next case is just around the corner, I'm sure.
This whole research thing was actually really cool because it's like drilling a hole into the phone and then inserting a wire into that chip directly in order to. So basically what the whole process entails is the iPhone has this kind of, you know, number of tries that you can do the pin and get it wrong, and then it, you know, kicks in its security methods. So this would be a matter of allowing to kind of intercept and rewrite the tracking data on the number of missed entries. So, for example, you could do 6 tries, tap into that chip, which is what he's talking about, and rewrite that code to 0. And so you just keep doing that. 6 tries, rewrite to 0. 6 tries, rewrite to 0. It would really only take brute force for a 4-digit pin would take around 24 hours of that method. So not long at all, which seems so, on the surface, seems pretty darn simple. Like you have to, I would assume that a team at the FBI would consider something along those lines. How can we, you know, reset the retry code, you know, and come up with this? So it just kind of, at least to me, makes it seem more and more likely like the FBI really wanted this to be a precedent setting case. Mm-hmm. And turns out it didn't work in their favor.
Yeah. After the break, find out if Twitter's simulcast of Thursday Night Football was a touchdown or a backward pass. But first, let's take a minute to thank Zerto, the sponsor of this episode. IT asset protection, disaster recovery, and cloud continuity for confident CIOs. That is Zerto. Confidence can make or break businesses in today's IT world. It can mean the difference between hesitation and action, success or relevance. Zerto's cloud-based business continuity solutions arm today's CIOs and IT pros with the confidence to know their systems are ready for anything. With Zerto, you can recover from downtime, test new technology, and you can move to the cloud in a matter of clicks, all while maintaining business continuity. Zerto's virtual replication technology gives you the power to simplify your migrations, switch to new infrastructure faster, and get quicker ROI in a matter of clicks. Know your data is protected by breakthrough hypervisor-based software that puts the power of continuous replication right at your fingertips. Migrate to the cloud with no disruptions with enterprise-class software that empowers you to seamlessly and safely move virtualized workloads between public, private, and hybrid clouds. Get complete comprehensive data protection in one smart solution for BCDR across storage and hypervisors. Recover from any disruption with checkpoints every few seconds. Check and protect your and recover your files, VMs, and applications from any point in time. See for yourself how Zerto simplifies your data replication and disaster recovery. Plus, get a free readiness assessment for your data center at confidentcio.com. That's confidentcio.com, and we thank Zerto for their support.
So as we were saying a few minutes back, social networks are coming for our presidential elections, and almost as important, they're also coming for our football. Joining us to talk about last night's NFL game on Twitter is Kurt Wagner from Recode. How's it going, Kurt?
It's great. They're coming for our football.
They're coming for our football. They're coming for our touchdowns. So yesterday was the first Thursday night game streamed to Twitter. How did you happen to catch the game?
I watched the first half on my mobile phone. I wanted it to feel kind of authentic, if you will. So I just watch it the normal way I go home, walk to the bus, watch it on the bus, made a stop at the grocery store, watched it in the grocery store, and got home. I was planning to watch the second half on Apple TV. Found out that the Apple TV I have is, I believe, third generation, doesn't have an app store, and therefore did not have the Twitter Apple TV app, which was a big bummer. So I ended up watching on a laptop for the second half. But overall, it was, you know, the stream was fine. You're looking at my review right there. I thought there were definitely a lot of things that could be improved. But, I mean, for a first go-around, I thought it was pretty successful.
So I guess let's start with streaming quality. We were here recording an episode of Know How. We were middle of the show, and I was like, oh, NFL, I could get that on my browser. So I tried it and checked it out. I was actually pretty impressed, at least on my laptop screen. You know, when I went full screen with the stream, it was a nice, pretty sharp HD. It looked pretty good to me. What did you think?
I had a similar experience on my phone. It was really sharp for probably the first 45 minutes. Yeah, there's me on the bus catching the game. I got a great seat in the back. It did, though, get spotty after about 45 minutes, and I have no idea why, like what happened, because the other things on my phone seemed to be working, like texting and emailing and all that stuff. But once it got blurry, it never went back, and that was a huge bummer because, you know, if it hadn't been for me experimenting with this and testing it, I would have just closed the app and gotten rid of it. I don't know who to blame for that, right? Like, is that a Twitter fault? Is that Verizon's fault? Is that my local, you know, neighborhood tower's fault? I really don't know. But I would say when it was clear, which was the majority of the time, it was super clear. It was very HD and it looked great.
Nice. I watched it on my fourth generation Apple TV. I did it for you because like football. But I was watching in the third quarter and it still seemed fine. I mean, you know, I guess I read online and read in your article that it was a little bit of a lag. I didn't know, because if you're watching on the TV, you don't have Twitter scrolling right next to you. All you have is just the game, like you were watching it like in the old-fashioned days. You also had commercials, which I'm not used to because I've been a cord cutter. But, you know, and then they had this weird thing where, like, it would just say, we will return shortly. Like, it was like 1975 and I was watching I don't know what. Like, you know, do-do-do-do. Right. So I don't know what that was about. Like, do you have any idea?
Well, so I know that Twitter was supposed to sell the local TV ads. So in a game like this is nationally broadcasted, I want to say the breakdown, and I'm kind of pulling these numbers out of my head, but I don't know how accurate exactly they are. I want to say it's maybe 85-15, right? 85% are national ads that everyone's going to see. 15% are going to be local ads that are going to be targeted to each individual city. Twitter was supposed to have the ability to sell those local ads, so that small 10 to 15 to 20% of the ads. And my understanding was they've been selling them and have sold a lot of them, but perhaps they did not sell all of them, and therefore had a couple of vacant ad spots where they just put up what are called house ads for either mm-hmm. Twitter's own stream or for the NFL. That's my best bet. I do not know for sure. Maybe they were having technical difficulties in serving those ads, in which case that would be a great story. Someone should make some calls about that. But, I would imagine that these were just like there was some open ad inventory, and so they filled it with some space until they, you know, ideally would fill all that stuff. But this is me speculating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about the stream of tweets, the tweets that accompanied the game on the side? I mean, this is a Twitter product after all, mm-hmm. so it's, you know, partially about the game, but it's also, I think, a way for Twitter to kind of show the strengths of its network. Were they on point? Were they?
Yeah, so this was my biggest issue with the whole experience, to be honest with you. So, I mean, the game, we already talked about, the stream seemed fine. I was able to watch in the grocery store. That's cool. I would love to be able to do that. But, you know, I could have been watching CBS's stream, or I could have been watching the NFL Network app, or I could have been watching Facebook for all, you know, I know. It was just, I didn't get the experience that it was anything special to Twitter. And there was a stream of tweets right next to the game, so that is fine. My issue with that was that it wasn't, you know, it was curated clearly in the sense that, like, they did a good job of keeping out racist comments or terrible, people bantering back and forth and swearing. Mm-hmm. I didn't see any of that. That was successful. But it was also just a bunch of people I have no idea who they are, right? Like Joe from Ohio talking about this great touchdown catch, or, you know, someone else from Nebraska who's saying whatever. Like, with all due respect to those people, I have no interest in hearing them talk about the football game. I wanted to see a curated feed of, like, NFL experts and journalists and former players and current players. And I thought Twitter really could have taken the time to, you know, curate a feed of tweets and say, like, when you come to Twitter, you don't just hear from the random neighbor next door. Like, you hear from really important, influential people. Mm-hmm. And here we've compiled a whole list of them for you. That was my one issue. My second issue was, like, think of all the things that Twitter could have done that are unique to Twitter, right? Like, okay, there's a play at the goal line that's under review. Let's throw up a quick poll and see what the viewers think. Was it a touchdown? Wasn't a touchdown? Everyone votes in the next, you know, minute and a half, and we'll see what the crowd wants. Or here's the players that have been mentioned the most. Here's the moment of the game that caused the most tweets, that spiked the Twitter engagement. There were just so many things that I thought they could have done that would have been Twittery, and they didn't do any of them. So as a result, it was a cool, clean feed of the game. But to me, it had no, like, the fact that it was on Twitter didn't mean much other than that I already had the app on my phone, so it was easy to find.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's great for those of us who are cord cutters, you know, because we couldn't have watched it on our TV. But yeah, I mean, there was in the third quarter, like one of the quarterbacks got taken off because of concussion protocol. Mm-hmm. And that was really the only thing I was interested in. And, you know, but there was no other way for me to, like, I'm on the Apple TV, I'm connected to the internet. Like, you know, the Apple TV is supposed to feed me all this information. It could have given me some more background on what that meant and what the history of that was and that right. sort of thing.
There are experts out there too, like accounts that are even, you know, NFL doctor type accounts that mm-hmm. people follow. I mean, how great in that moment would it have been for someone, you know, someone behind the scenes at Twitter to be like, hey, concussion protocol is going on. We're going to surface, you know, the tweets from these three people and we're just going to pin them right to the top, right? Like, or you know, we're going to insert them. You would never have been able to find them. Instead, all you got was, again, random guy X or random girl Y just saying like, hope he, you know, is he going to come back? He's on my fantasy team, right? Like that was the stuff that I kept seeing. And to me, that doesn't do much.
Yeah, yeah. So the NFL has revealed that Twitter saw 2.1 million viewers last night. That's compared to 48.1 million on TV. What do you think about the numbers? Is that a good first showing? Would you have expected that to be higher? It's the NFL yeah. after all.
Yeah, I mean, from my understanding, that was in line with what they were hoping for. Okay. So I guess in that sense, like success, right? If that's what Twitter and the NFL and the whoever the partners wanted, I was told somewhere between like 1.5 and 2.5 million. So that's right in there. Good for them. The thing that's really tough is like, what does that mean, right? So mm-hmm. When Yahoo streamed a game last, I guess it was October, they actually did a much larger average audience. So Twitter, you know, 2.1 million total, but it was only an average audience of about 243,000 at any given time. Yahoo's average audience was 2.3 million, like 10 times that. The difference is Yahoo was streaming it autoplay on every property they owned, right? Tumblr, Mail, Yahoo homepage. So it's like it's not an apples-to-apples comparison, but at the same time, Yahoo's number looks much bigger than Twitter's. And then you get to TV. TV had like 48 million people, which makes Twitter's 2 million look silly, right? So it's just really hard. This is all such an experiment, and it's also new, that it's really it's almost unfair to try and compare Twitter's audience with the TV audience or even with Yahoo's audience. I think what this does, though, and what I wrote in my story today, was this sets a benchmark, right? So, okay, now we know the first game generated 2.1 million. Let's see what the next five generate, right? And if all of a sudden it goes from 2.1 to 1.8 to 1.6 to, yeah. you know, whatever, like, okay, clearly this is not something that's going to, it doesn't seem to be catching on. But I think it's a good foundation, and I'm going to kind of leave it at that just because it's such a new thing that we don't really know even where to look.
And finally, probably the most important question, how was the game?
It was okay for my fantasy team.
So oh, okay. You should have tweeted that.
I should have led with that. Yeah. Well, here was actually a thing I didn't think about. I was watching on Recode's Twitter account. I was dual phoning my own phone to take photos of me watching on the Recode phone, which sounded cool. But then I was like, wow, I can't really interact with anybody because I shouldn't probably do that from the Recode account. I should do that from Kurt's account. So I didn't tweet during the game last night, which isn't uncommon, but also it probably would have been a good time to experiment with that. But
yeah.
Oh, well.
Next time. It. Hey, next time. I bet they do this on Thursday.
Yeah,
next Thursday.
Exactly. Right on. Kurt Wagner, always a pleasure getting you on the show. Tell people where they can follow your work online.
Yeah, thank you. We're at recode.net. We got a bunch of stuff about Twitter and other great news and insight there. And then KurtWagner8 is what I'm at on Twitter.
Excellent. Thanks again, Kurt. Have a great weekend.
Yep. Thanks, Kurt. Guys. Bye.
All right. Bye, guys.
Well, huge, huge thanks to Brady Redfern, who is a user experience engineer and a PhD candidate at Virginia Tech. He has chronicled his experience with Project Wing's burrito drone delivery that we've been talking about. Now, Brady emailed us this morning at 11 a.m. Eastern time to tell us he was in line for the burrito drone delivery. And then he sent us lots of photos and videos of getting the food delivered, including this photo of the delivery fee, which costs $5.99. That's just for the delivery after you pay. On top of the burrito. And that's, it was delivered for 200 meters. So that's how much it cost. But he also sent us a couple videos of the drone landing. And I think we can take a look at them. It looks bigger than I imagined. I know we showed this video yesterday, but it was sort of far away. This one was hands-on video.
I know. When I saw these videos this morning, I was like, wait a minute, was he the one of the video yesterday? And, it turns out, and it actually makes a lot of sense. This is a very orchestrated thing.
Yes.
Like, they've got the same field, the same plane coming to the same field, and the same people running out to pick up the burrito from the field to bring it to the person that ordered it. So all the video actually kind of looks the same as a result.
Yeah. And he did also send us this great video of his kids, his daughters, watching the burrito being delivered by drone, which is sort of like someone watching the moon landing a little bit, like, you know, now looking back.
Well, yeah, it's like, okay, so this is their childhood. Their childhood is that it's somewhat normal for a little miniature airplane to come and deliver you food from the sky. Like, I would love that if that was my childhood. What does that mean for 20 years from now? I don't know.
No, I don't know.
But this is normal.
Yeah. Like, they're going to be like, where were you when you had your first burrito delivered by drone? I remember where I was. So, yeah, super cute. Thank you so much, Brady, for sending us all those videos. And
did he mention if it was any good?
He said it was good. He's smiling. There's the picture. It was warm. Like I said, it was 200 meters away. That's how far it had to go.
It's like a tenth of a mile, basically.
It didn't actually come from Mexico or anything.
It's probably on the other side of the trees we saw there is the Chipotle.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's a good.
It's a start.
Yes, it is.
It's a start. I want an air burrito. Snowden has infiltrated the movie theaters, and Sam Moskovich from Ars Technica is going to tell us what he thinks about the new film. But before we get there, let's take a minute to thank Gazelle. They are the sponsor of this episode. Gazelle is the trusted online marketplace for buying and selling used electronics. You can trade in your old device and get cash. You can buy a certified pre-owned device, or you can do both. Why not? For trade-ins, simply visit gazelle.com, find your device, and you'll get an instant quote. Shipping is free and payment is super fast. And if you're looking to buy a certified pre-owned device, Gazelle has a variety of iPhones, including the iPhone 6S, and the iPhone 6S Plus, iPads, Samsung, Galaxy phones, tons of different devices to choose from. Each device is fully inspected, backed by a 30-day return policy, and sold without a carrier contract. Go to gazelle.com, see what your old device is worth, check out the selections of certified pre-owned devices, and you can do that all in one place, one-stop shop. Gazelle is now providing financing on all devices by Affirm. You simply provide your basic information. You'll get instantly approved and pay off in 3, 6, or 12 months. Easy monthly payments that can be made through bank transfer, check, or debit card. Just select financing with Affirm at checkout. Gazelle also offers a 12-month warranty for cell phones and iPads powered by Assurance Solutions. That covers water damage, cracked screens, hardware defects, and more. Help is available 24/7 to process those claims and return your device right away. And you don't want to miss out on getting the best value on certified pre-owned devices. Get in there while they have them. Visit gazelle.com. The benefits of buying pre-owned devices from Gazelle, I mean, there's tons of benefits, basically. Devices are available in good and excellent condition. Good condition shows some gentle signs of wear and tear, what you might expect after using a device for a little bit of time, but it offers consumers great prices on still great devices. All devices have been put through a rigorous 30-point inspection process. That's to make sure that they're in perfect working order before they get shipped out to you. Devices available for support by major carriers, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, and Sprint, and all the products that you would hope at this point, iPhone 5S, 6, iPad Air, iPad Mini, Galaxy S5, Galaxy S6, all across the map. Give new life to used electronics. You can trade in for cash or buy certified pre-owned, or both. Visit gazelle.com to learn more today. And we thank Gazelle for their support.
Oliver Stone's new biopic, Snowden, is out. And Sam Moskovich from Ars Technica is here with his review. Welcome, Sam.
Hello, hello, everyone. How's it going?
It's going well. So I've heard that Snowden doesn't fare much better than the most recent Jobs biopic, that it sort of contains some forced and trite imagery, like things like a Rubik's Cube used to signify genius, for example. What did you think?
Honestly, I went into this with pretty low expectations. A biopic about something that's still ongoing is sort of an interesting subject choice. There was clearly a race to get a Snowden movie out. I actually got to talk to Mr. Stone today on Skype, of all things. Oh, nice. He did not have duct tape over his camera on his device, although I think he was actually borrowing somebody else's, but that's neither here nor there. And I found it very interesting because there was a report about the crazy making of this movie that went live at the New York Times either yesterday or the day before. Conveniently, he said, I haven't read it, didn't comment on it. I heartily recommend you look it up. It's nuts. But it sounds like a lot of weird stuff happened to get this movie made. One thing was that they bought the rights to a script or a book that was written by a Russian lawyer who represents Snowden overseas. And this movie doesn't actually use any of that book, Oliver Stone told me, because basically at the 11th hour, he managed to get Snowden, he says, to come on board and essentially not be a major advisor, but to simply give little bits of here and there checks. And as a result, this is actually a relatively accurate portrayal with a lot of weird dramatization. It's really hard to explain how that balance plays out without seeing it, because I feel like at every turn you have something that actually makes logical sense that follows the normal timeline of things that happened, and then you run into something where there's a character named after somebody in 1984 who's like a member of the CIA, as if that couldn't be more like right on the nose in terms of what the movie is trying to say about our current surveillance state, as it were. But ultimately, I really found myself liking the movie more than I expected for one reason. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, wow, I don't know words today. Joseph Gordon-Levitt at playing Edward Snowden is unbelievable. Best Actor of the Year nominee, hands down, because through all of this dramatic, cheesy chaos. Remember, Nicolas Cage shows up within the first 15 minutes. If that gives you any sort of compass of how kind of odd this movie can get.
Any really big explosions behind Nicolas Cage when he's there?
No, but he does absolutely appear at the end of the movie in like a cheesy 80s, yeah, kind of way out of nowhere. It's like, the laughter in the press screening was just riotous just at that moment. It certainly was not meant to be that way. But every time things get cheesy, Gordon-Levitt really nails making this very subtle, subdued character work. He never pounds on a desk, starts shouting about freedom and about feeling like his faith in the system's been fractured. It's so much show, don't tell, which is sort of a cheesy way of putting it. But he really is given room to show what his experience was like, to let the different narrative beats play out in a way that let him not act all overdramatic. He never really shouts anything major. In fact, the most declarative things he ends up saying are usually near the beginning of the movie about he's given a polygraph test as he starts training for the CIA, and they ask, is America the greatest country on the earth? And he says yes, and he doesn't phase. And a lot of other things he says about duty, about caring about the country, about coming from a family of service with a father and a grandfather who'd worked for the FBI and for the Coast Guard. Things like that. So he's really set up as sort of a conservative, almost libertarian in certain parts of the beginning. But, you know, duty ends up being the leading call for him. And that plays out in this very interesting way, because he's facing these programs while going through the NSA. There's a little bit of dramatization. There's actually on the screen right now, they show this sort of hipster hacker who's chewing on gum and is calling Snowden Snow White and all this sort of cheesiness. And so that sort of stuff, every turn of the movie, something tries to derail the core issue of what this person, Edward Snowden, went through in order to disclose. And what he found, what he disclosed, how he did it, and the relationship and health that it cost him in order to do so. Movie centers on Snowden in a way that I think is just very striking and interesting. I don't know that I would say it's like best film of the year or must see. I don't think that it illuminates things that we as Snowden followers didn't already know. Actually, interestingly, it uses some plot beats that you might have learned about if you had read Ars Technica's forums, where Edward Snowden was a longtime member. We had a report come up a couple years ago when the story broke about the nickname of his that had been uncovered, matching up perfectly with an account at Ars Technica talking about things like breaking his legs during army training, things like that. And those plot beats are in the movie, which, you know, that how I've never worked somewhere where I've been able to say something like that. All in all, there is both more cheese and less cheese than I expected. Actually, technology is treated in a very subtle way. You get no faked GUIs. You'd get nothing that looks like a crappy CSI Miami sort of thing where they show, you know, enhance and a cheap fake computer screen. Right. Everything is like a real crappy Telnet interface. There's actually one point where they use this awful GUI that looks like something from Windows 3.1 that's a heat map, the entire internet surveillance pattern. And I looked at it and I said, that looks like actual military software in terms of being, you know, form definite or a function definitely over form, excuse me. So there's lots of different technology things that are nailed. There's lots of things about Snowden himself that are nailed. I'm sorry, I am kind of rambling because it is an Oliver Stone movie. And I feel like to really appreciate an Oliver Stone movie is to ramble through the emotional beats and the hitting over your head and really on the nose stuff. But yeah. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, from what it sounds like, especially in the New York Times piece, sounds like he really fought to turn down the Snowden-specific stuff, the things he said and the way he acts. That comes through. If he doesn't win an Oscar, then that will mean there was an even better performance than this, and that would be good for filmgoers. So that, on that reason alone, this is a much better movie than I expected. And bravo, surprise bravo to Oliver Stone for pulling this off.
Yeah, I think my only question for you on this was whether Oliver Stone was restrained at all. But I know that that's a silly question because that's not Oliver Stone's way.
Yeah, yeah.
So this week, the House Intelligence Committee came out with a report on Snowden's disclosures. How did the movie compare with that report in terms of accuracy on either side?
So if you go to Edward Snowden's Twitter account, he specifically cites scenes in the movie that are referenced in the House report. There's certain attempts by the House committee to discredit, to say that Snowden was sort of an overclaimer and a falsifier. And they talked about certain things. And he said, you can watch the movie. That exact thing that they're talking about, its context is laid out in the movie. He's like, that, if anything, it seems to that the way that that document reads, if you combine that with what Snowden says, is good advertising for this movie, because it does, after reading that and then seeing what Snowden said and remembering those scenes, I go, that makes sense. That makes sense. The way that the condemnations that they issue are very brief in that report, and Snowden connects those dots in a way. So I don't know that necessarily he's answered to every single one of those things. I think that the conversation is going to continue for some time about, was he a traitor? Did he do the right thing in terms of how he disclosed all these files? Now, remember, one thing that both this film and the documentary Citizen 4 really stressed with that they didn't have very much time once Snowden exposed himself. Once he said, I am this person, I am with the NSA or contractor of the NSA, here are the files. At that point, the clock was ticking. So the big issue that especially our commenters at Ars Technica have talked about is, did he disclose responsibly? It was a lot of data that was dumped. Some of those files eventually did get outside of Glenn Greenwald's grasp, and we're not sure exactly what damage that did or didn't do. But ultimately, in terms of him wanting to get information out and to do so as a quote-unquote patriot, this film does try to make that case. I know Oliver Stone, when I was talking to him, he made a point of, you know, I've never heard of a spy who does stuff like this without seeking a paycheck. Snowden wasn't looking for a paycheck. You can see every single thing he's done. He's been very much above the board ever since exposing himself. There hasn't been this great paper trail of money or of fame or of specific communication with Russians or Chinese. There's not going to be a really solid answer to things until somebody sets a path for either Snowden's pardon or for Snowden to get a public trial, the kind where everything will be out in the open, no like hidden suppressed trial. I don't see either of those things happening anytime soon based on that House report, however. Yeah. But certainly, if enough people see this film and there are enough calls out there, who knows what Obama could do before the end of his lame duck term. But I don't see that carpet has been rolled out just, and I certainly don't think that this film is going to put anything over the top. I don't see anyone seeing this movie in our intelligence groups, in our military group, and saying, oh, now I get it. I think everybody who's involved with things kind of knows what the stakes were and been acting accordingly.
I don't know. Oliver Stone has a lot of pull.
Well, what about Citizen 4, the documentary? Do you recommend people watch that first before they see, or is it basically you don't need to watch that anymore now that the Stone movie's out?
Oh, if you tell me which one to see, I will always say Citizen 4, because I think that is such a landmark of the entire world. That is such an internationally fascinating moment, captured in a really interesting way, really tells a lot of stories at once. It sets a lot of the context that I think the Snowden film also happens to do, because it pulls in footage of other people talking about metadata accumulation and degrees of separation from suspects that have been targeted by these collection agencies. The Snowden film, I think, is for people who would never really watch a documentary. I would hand this movie to my mother, for example. My mother, my father, other family members who wouldn't necessarily sit down with a documentary and say, if you get out of this movie and don't put duct taped over your webcam on your laptop, then I will be shocked. I think it does a really good job of telling that sort of story and of painting Snowden in a clearly biased but certainly convincing way of patriotism being at least some aspect of why he did what he did.
Well, Sam, thank you so much. As always, Sam is the culture editor at Ars Technica, and he is Sam Red on Twitter. And we will see you hopefully next week.
Indeed. Thank you, Sam. Have a good weekend.
Take care.
Have a good night. TNT's fan of the day is at Third Gen on Twitter, who says, hours of melting glass listening to many Twitch shows. Thanks for all the info.
Is that a haiku? It sounds like a haiku.
Kind of does, but I think literal too. Because
what's she melting the glass?
I'm not sure what it is, but it's a cool picture. And she's melting glass. I believe her. I believe you, Jen.
Probably to make things like the strawberries and on her Twitter picture.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Look at this. Aha, see, I missed that. You're right. That's probably exactly what it is. Wow, very talented. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we will find it.
After the break, what kind of Apple superfans did you see waiting in line at the Apple Store? We might have found one of the weirdest. But first, let's take a minute to thank Wealthfront, the sponsor of this episode. You invest for the long term for you or your family's financial health, but trying to do it yourself, especially the right way, is complex and time-consuming. Luckily, there is Wealthfront. Traditional advisors charge huge fees, between 1% and 3% of what they manage. But with Wealthfront, you pay 0.25% a year. That's 25 basis points, zero commissions, and no hidden fees. That's less than $5 a month to invest a $30,000 account. There are no additional charges for any of Wealthfront's services. You can get started investing today with as little as $500. Unlike other financial advisors, Wealthfront won't bog you down with dozens of questions. They've simplified their risk identification process, which allows you to begin investing sooner. It only takes a few minutes to sign up. It goes right to work monitoring your portfolios around the clock, and it takes action as soon as an opportunity arises. Wealthfront portfolios are based on modern portfolio theory, and they're designed to adjust according to your personal risk tolerance while staying diversified and tax efficient. Wealthfront is transparent and accessible. You can view and track all your accounts in one place. Wealthfront can track both your Wealthfront and your non-Wealthfront bank and brokerage accounts that they will provide in a summary of all your assets. You can see every trade that Wealthfront makes on your behalf in your dashboard, on your desktop, or with their mobile app. Wealthfront recently introduced their 529 college savings plan, allowing you to invest after-tax dollars, much like a Roth IRA, and save for your child or your grandchild's higher education expenses. I am going to hopefully have three kids in college at the same time. I wish I could use Wealthfront to invest in their 529 plans, but I can't because they're in advertisers. But you can. So what are you waiting for? Invest in your future today with Wealthfront. Visit Wealthfront.com/TNT to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. You'll see the customized allocation they recommend for your profile. And just for you Twit listeners or viewers, if you sign up to invest, Wealthfront will manage your first $15,000 entirely free of charge for life. Join the many Twit fans who've seen huge success with Wealthfront and claim your offer today at Wealthfront.com/TNT. Tokyo Apple fan Ayano Tominaga once again camped out in front of the Apple Store to be one of the first to get their latest products. She was able to sleep soundly on the street for those two nights because she brought along her Steve Jobs body pillow. Y'all thought I was crazy for Apple. There she is. She's been doing this for many years. She camped out for the iPad in 2011. She camped out last year for the iPhone, the year before for the iPhone. She is serious, and she's brought her body pillow with her.
She looks serious.
It's quite clean, considering she's sleeping on the street waiting for this.
It's a pillow that's been, well, yeah, I wonder if it's only reserved exclusively for iPhone launches.
I don't know.
If so, this question. Pillow has maybe had 6 or 7 uses.
True. If so, she does, yeah. I guess there's that. Maybe she washes the pillowcase too. I mean, it's not reserved only for iPhone launches because she did wait for the iPad in 2020. Okay. So,
all right.
We know that.
I don't know how to feel about this one.
But Matt Black.
Good for you. Whatever it takes to get that matte black iPhone, I suppose I support it. Whatever. Even if it includes a Steve Jobs body pillow.
It's such a weird, it is so weird that we're doing this, that we get so crazy like this. It is weird.
We're not the ones getting crazy.
No, but I mean, I am eager to get my phone, which, you know, but I'm not as eager as she is.
obviously not. Unless you have a body pillow with somebody, you know, with Steve Jobs on it that we don't know about.
I don't choose to say.
Okay. That's probably best. I won't tell you about who's on my body pillow. Never mind. TNT. Why do I open my mouth sometimes? TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be a part of the show by emailing us, tnt@twit.tv. You can leave us a short voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. You can find us on Twitter at TechNewsTodayTV.
And you can find all the ways to subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to tweet at me about your body pillow, I'm at Megan Maroney.
Yes, question of the day. Do you have a body pillow? And if so, who's on it? And I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director, Kara. Thanks to Alex for scrolling the words. It's so good to have you here, Alex. We really appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks to Kevin for editing and making us look good. And thanks to The Weeknd, because it starts now. Thank you for talking tech with us today. We'll see y'all on Monday. Bye, everyone.